Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. The Prop 4 repeal is on the brink of failing to make midterm a ballot despite a rushed change to the Utah law. At the Utah governor's mansion, protesters decry an ICE detention center planned for a Salt Lake City warehouse. How the Trump administration may erase history and science at Utah's national parks. And record heat is fast-tracking Utah's already dire water outlook. Joining me on the program today are Salt Lake Tribune politics reporter Robert Gerke. Robert, thank you.
Hey, Tom. Good morning.
Good morning. We have with us reporter Sam Moylan. Sam, thanks.
Hey, Tom. Good morning. Thanks.
Good morning. Thank you. And reporter Brooke Larson is with us. Brooke, thank you.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Let's start with Robert Gerke. We've been talking about this, the Prop 4 repeal. The saga's ongoing. Robert, it might be worth it, maybe just every once in a while, to remind ourselves what Prop 4 would do, first of all.
Yeah, so Prop 4 was the 2018 ballot initiative that established these independent redistricting commission and the ban on partisan gerrymandering. Prohibited manipulating the districts to advantage Republicans and disadvantage Democrats, well, one party over the other. And the legislature mostly repealed it. A couple years later, the Supreme Court said that that repeal was unconstitutional because it deprived citizens the right to the ballot initiative. So what the Republican Party's doing is they've created this group, Utahns for Representative Government, that's trying to run its own initiative. That would repeal Proposition 4 and give the legislature the power back to redistrict as it sees fit, you know, whether it wants to gerrymander or not. And so they had to go out and get 141,000 signatures, roughly. They easily cleared that. But one of the other criteria to get this on the ballot is they have to get a certain number of signatures. It's 8% of the registered voters in 26 of the 29 Senate districts. And as of today, they're still hanging on to that. They've got the 26, but just barely. The numbers have fallen because there's this window for 45 days for people to remove their signatures, and a lot of people have. I think over 8,300 people have statewide right now, and there's one district in particular, Senate District 15, sort of in the southern part of Salt Lake County, that is just barely hanging on as of today.
So this is, I assume, those people wanting to remove their signatures, that count does not include those who use the prepaid envelopes that were sent out?
Well, yeah. So the groups that were opposed to the repeal of Proposition 4, we're talking about Better Boundaries and a group called the Brave Utahns Rapid Response Network, have been out trying to, you know, beat the bushes and try to get people to remove their signatures. One of the things they were doing is distributing these forms, the removal forms, with the envelope that had prepaid postage on it. The Utahns for Representative Government sued over that. And on the last night of the legislative session, literally in the last hour of the legislative session, there was a bill that was amended to make it illegal for clerks to accept removal forms that are in prepaid envelopes after the date of the enactment of the bill. They passed it, like I said, in the last hour of the last night, sent it to the governor's desk at about 2 a.m. and he signed it within hours of that. And so from that point on, anybody who submitted those forms through in a prepaid envelope, those weren't counted. And so they just made it a little bit more difficult for these groups that had spent, you know, tens of thousands of dollars on this postage to get those signatures removed.
By the way, the legislature, I guess, asserted in that bill that this constituted a, 30-cent bribe or whatever, however much the postage costs?
Yeah, it's I think 73 cents is what
70. Oh, that's what it's up to now. Yes.
Yeah, I didn't know that actually. That was a revelation. I haven't sent.
Yeah, I haven't either. Yeah.
So yeah, but yeah, they said it's like it was against the law before this to give anybody anything of value in exchange for their removal, and so that was the argument that they were making, was that 73 cents is a thing of value that would be prohibited under the law. But once this bill passed, the legislature and the governor signed it, They dropped their lawsuit, but the Salt Lake County clerk, for example, which is the one I was focused on because that's where Senate District 15 is, said that she had received about 285 of these removal forms in prepaid envelopes in the window, after that bill became law. So people who'd like postmarked it, dropped it in the mail on Friday or Saturday, or didn't know that the new law hit was in effect and sent it in anyway. So it's made it a little bit more challenging for these groups, but the numbers continue to fall precipitously, actually. As recently as 9 days ago, it was about that one key Senate district that we were talking about was 658 signatures over the threshold, and as of just I just checked it as we were going on the air, it's now at 102 signatures over the threshold. So they a lot of people are still removing them. There's they have until April 23rd to submit the removal forms, so we're kind of watching and waiting, I guess.
That was getting my next question. April 23rd is the deadline.
Correct. Yeah, April
Yeah.
23rd. It has to be done within 45 days of the initial signature. Say you signed the petition, the clerks go and validate those, and the removal has to be submitted within 45 days. But the removal period closed, so the last batch of them were posted a few weeks ago. April 23rd is the drop dead deadline for removals. Yeah.
It seems like a pretty high number of removal of signatures. Is this a trend or is just this particular issue?
Well, yeah, I mean it is. We haven't really seen sort of a concerted effort like this for a long time, and so we don't have a really good comparison. There was once in 2018, there was the Count My Vote initiative that was that they were trying to get on the ballot, and it also had qualified in 26 of the 29 Senate districts, but there was enough opposition to it in one of the Senate districts in particular that there were enough withdrawals to knock it off the ballot. So it's not unprecedented. But yeah, I mean, we're talking 8,300 plus signatures have been removed since this started. The opponents of the repeal effort say that that's an indication that people feel like they were deceived or tricked into signing and didn't want to sign. But, because there had been these allegations back and forth, I think we talked about it on the program before, about the allegations that the tactics that the proponents of the repeal were using were misleading.
So April 23rd, the deadline, and this only has to fail in one of these Senate districts to make the overall thing fail.
Right. It's right on the cusp right now. The legislature isn't fond of ballot initiatives, so they've made it really difficult to get these on. So the 26 of 29 Senate districts, that threshold they have to meet. They are, like I said, right there as of today in all 26 that they need. But again, if it falls off in any one of those, they fail to make the ballot. There's also potential that there could be litigation over either this envelope issue could be revived, or they could, they could go to court and argue that some of the signatures that they invalidated were improperly invalidated and should have been counted. So there's, we may or may not know on April 23rd, one way or the other, definitively that this is or is not going to be on the ballot. It's sort of the ongoing saga, the gift that keeps on giving for journalists, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. If the repeal effort is unsuccessful, if the measure makes it to the November ballot, that I understand would not affect the districts for this time around.
Correct. So the if it makes it on the ballot in November, we'll obviously be on that same ballot. We'll be electing new members of Congress, so that court ordered district will be in effect for 2026. It essentially would just give the legislature the ability to redistrict however it wants in 2028 or after the next census in 2030, when Utah is expected to get a fifth seat.
We're talking with Robert Gerke, politics reporter for the Tribune. Let's go to another story just published this morning. The headline, Kalshi contests it's not a gambling app. Governor Cox says the prop betting app quacks like a duck. So this is a dispute between one of the, I guess, one of the big two proposition markets and the state of Utah. Tell me about this.
Right, Kalshi is this platform where you can put, as they argue, you're buying a futures contract, and so Utah State University is playing its NCAA tournament today. You could put $20 on the proposition that they will win their game, which of course they will. Go Aggies.
Go Aggies.
And if they do win, you win money. So, Governor Cox and others in the state have said, well, that's clearly online betting, sports betting, right? And Kalshi argues that it's not. It's a futures. You're trading like you would with corn or soybeans or something like that. And so the state has in the last session passed a bill that clarified that prop bets are indeed, sports betting. Kalshi, before the bill even passed, went to court and sued and said, well, states don't get to regulate futures trades. It's only the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, which is a federal board that regulates, like I said, corn and soybeans and other futures. And so this is something that states all across the country are dealing with. In Arizona this week, the attorney general there filed criminal charges against Kalshi because they said they were operating a sports book and allowed betting or facilitated betting on elections, which is also prohibited there, as well as in Utah. So the governor said he's supportive of Arizona's move to crack down on Kalshi, and would like to see Utah follow suit. And so, this is something that the attorney general has said his office is looking into. But there have not been any criminal charges filed yet. And in fact, right now, that lawsuit that Kalshi filed against the state is on hold. The court filing said they've been in some discussions with the state and would like those discussions to continue. And so for up to 60 days, that lawsuit's on hold.
So the governor's saying it quacks like a duck. It is a duck. What is tell me again, maybe a little more about what Kalshi is saying. I'm sure they're saying that this is completely different. It's
Completely
completely
different, of
different.
course.
What are they saying?
Well, what their argument is that, it's not a wager. You're not betting on a team winning or not. You're buying a futures contract, an event contract. And you can do these on any number of things. You could have bet, that one battle after another was going to win Best Picture, or you can bet that, the Democrats will retake the House of Representatives, or all of these different things you can buy these contracts on. But the governor, of course, says that it acts just like a FanDuel or sports betting site, which is illegal in Utah. Utah's constitution, as we probably know, makes gambling illegal, and has since statehood. So it's this gray area, and Utah's not the only state dealing with this. A number of there Kalshi has gone to court in several states, including Nevada, and some of the courts have said that this is a sports gambling site, and it is subject to state regulation. Others have said no, this is not. It's a futures trade and is only subject to federal regulation. It's interesting, the commissioner of the Consumer or Financial Trading Commission, Futures Trading Commission, has said that, they believe this is the Trump administration believes that it is futures trading and it's only subject to federal regulation. The governor fired back at that on social media, saying, he's defending these billion-dollar companies that are trying to ruin people's lives, and especially young men. It's especially prominent. This sports betting or betting by another name is especially prominent among young college-age men.
Well, thanks for telling us about this, Robert
Yeah,
Gurney. Appreciate it.
yeah. We'll be back. I'm sure we've not heard the last of it.
I'm sure. Yeah, this will be heading through the courts, if nowhere else. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Coming up following a break, here's the headline we were talking about. At the Utah Governor's Mansion, protesters decry an ICE detention center planned for a Salt Lake City warehouse. We'll be talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Sam Moylan, and more following this break.
UPR's Spring Fund Drive starts soon, and you can help us get a head start on our goal by giving now at upr.org. If you're in a position to give at a higher level, consider joining other leadership donors in the UPR Producers Circle. This takes a gift of $1,200 annually. You'll be providing the significant capital we need to replace the large federal grants we've lost. and setting the standard for how our community can sustain world-class journalism on its own. Whatever amount works in your budget, make your gift now at upr.org.
Jackson, Mississippi guitarist Eddie Cott talks about his gospel roots and mission to bring blues to the world. Then Texas traveling songman guitarist Willis Allen Ramsey in a live set from New Orleans' Chickiwawa Club. It's Blues for Home and Highways on American Roots from PRX.
Tune in Saturday evening at 8 here on UPR.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We're bringing next Salt Lake Tribune reporter Sam Moylan. And Sam, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Let's talk about this. There's a protest. But first of all, tell me what they're protesting against. This is a newly announced big detention center?
Yes. Yeah. It was purchased by the Department of Homeland Security last week, and then they confirmed to us that it's going to be for, it's a warehouse that they purchased for a detention center.
Where is this? West Side, Salt Lake City's West Side?
West Side, right by the airport.
Right by the airport, yeah. So this is huge. This is one of, we've seen these in other cities, and now one planned for Salt Lake City. I know the mayor has spoken out. She doesn't want it, and these protesters don't want it. Tell me what happened at the protest.
Yeah, so it's Tuesday's protest was the first of two this week. This one was a smaller turnout. It was at noon, so the middle of the workday, but it was at the governor's mansion. We saw, I'd say, more than 100 people turned out. And the theme was drive out the snakes. It also happened to be St. Patrick's Day. So I think they kind of leaned into that theme as well. But everyone wore green. And a local artist made these like snake hand puppets that people were wearing. And it was, they called it a singing resistance, which I was told this form of protest kind of has a longer history, but it's recently started taking root after the fatal ICE killing of Renee Good in Minneapolis earlier this year. So a group there kind of formed this singing resistance that's kind of taken hold around the country right now. And in Utah, Sarah Buck, an organizer with Salt Lake Indivisible that organized this protest on Tuesday, said that this was their first time doing like this singing resistance protest here. So that was kind of cool to see. They basically did these like call and response songs. So like, you know, there was this woman that led it, Rebecca McCarthy, and she would sing the words out and then the crowd would kind of chant them back to her.
And I think several people you talked to are saying that singing resistance seems like more likely to not, you know, be in your face as much to people who are maybe counter-protesting or whatever, more likely to get people to join you.
Yeah, that was the whole point of it. Sarah Buck said that, you know, sometimes with anger, it can kind of seem, I don't know, more aggressive or more, you know, like in your face, and maybe could push some people away. But the whole point of the singing resistance is to have this like peaceful form of protest. And as she says, she's like, how can you be mad at someone that's, you know, singing their soul?
Mm-hmm. Now, this was at the governor's mansion, I guess, because they were trying to get the governor to not allow this to come here.
Yes, they were hoping that he, you know, would reconsider his position. He had said last year that he supports a detention center here so that migrants don't have to be transported to Vegas or other cities for processing. So they were kind of asking that he change his mind on that and shut down this new planned facility. But then, you know, at the time on Tuesday, he hadn't yet commented on the facility, but then just yesterday, had said that he does support it, but was a little frustrated with the fact that it was done kind of quietly and there wasn't any notification.
It's interesting. Among the, I guess, people who spoke, it was Floyd Maury, whose parents were in a Japanese detention camp during World War II. He kind of saw some similarities here.
I'm not sure if his parents were. I know that they immigrated here, though, and he grew up in Murray. And he's been a big part of the Japanese American Citizens League, and he kind of pointed to this the Topaz internment camp from World War II, kind of likening it to this detention facility and kind of his fears about this detention center, kind of echoing that history.
Yeah, reading the back to the story more carefully, I think I made that part up. Sorry for that.
That's okay.
His parents immigrated. They weren't involved in detention camps, but of course, many in the Japanese American community were. So let's go briefly to another story, Sam, that you did. Here's the headline. Before buying the Salt Lake City warehouse for a new detention center, ICE awarded a $10.4 million contract to transport people held there. So you found out that they were, before we knew about it, they were preparing for this facility.
Yeah, and this was around the time that in January when there was those rumors going around that they were going to purchase a different warehouse owned by the Ritchie Group, and that those rumors ended up not being true, or at least the Ritchie Group denied them. But it does seem like, with this transportation contract, they had been planning this.
Mm. I want to move to another story, and we've heard a version of this story, unfortunately, quite a few times. Here's the headline. A Utah man was arrested after suspected drugs turned out to be pinto beans. Once released, ICE detained him. This is a 22-year-old man. Tell me what happened.
Yeah, his name is Lorenzo Rascon. His family told me that he was driving some friends home one night in February, and they asked him to stop at a hotel. So he did, and his car was immediately surrounded by authorities. His cousin said that his friends tried to run away, but he stayed, and he was in the driver's seat, and he was kind of like, "What's going on?" Apparently authorities had, been planning some kind of drug bust. They had some tip. We're not exactly sure, how that came to be, but Lorenzo was taken into custody. But the interesting part about this case is that all they found when they searched the vehicle was a bag of dried pinto beans. And, his attorney said that they immediately knew that these were pinto beans. They didn't need to test them or anything. It was just blatantly obvious. But they did take Lorenzo into custody, but they never filed any charges. But ICE caught wind of it. So they, asked the jail to keep him so that they could take him into custody, which is what they did.
What was his immigration status prior to the arrest?
So he had a deferred action status. He had an ongoing asylum case for a long time that's kind of moved between the courts. But he had this U visa petition. It's like a temporary visa for undocumented people that agree to cooperate with law enforcement. And this places him in deferred action status. Basically, these U visas take a very, very long time to get approved. There's a long, long backlog that can take several years. So what they did is they said, okay, we have your petition and we think you have a case here. So we're going to, allow you to stay in the U.S. until we get to your petition. So you're basically safe until they have a decision. So because he had this status, a U.S. district judge granted a temporary restraining order blocking ICE from deporting him while Rascon challenges his detainment in federal court.
No, he says, this man says that he applied for asylum, wants asylum, because his brother was killed back in his home country.
Yes. So that's what brought him and his mother to the U.S. His older brother was killed in Mexico. And his cousin told me this. She said that, you know, they had people that they knew in Mexico that basically told them that they weren't safe. Apparently, you know, his brother was mistaken for someone else. And so the family just felt like they needed to flee. And they also had family in Utah, like the cousin that I spoke with. She's been here her whole life. So, you know, they felt like this was the best place for them to go. But when they got to the border seeking asylum, you know, they were initially denied and they were held in a detention center for about 2 months there. But then they were able to get their case heard and get that going in the courts. So they eventually made their way to Utah, and they've been trying to get asylum ever since.
Where is Mr. Russ going now? Do we know where he is?
Yes. He, as of last week, his attorney said he was in the Adelanto Center in California.
Mm-hmm. Now, a federal judge has put a block on deportation, but I guess we don't know what's next in his case.
Yeah. You know, they expect pretty soon to have a decision on his detainment, but he has, and whether he can be released, but that has not happened yet. I did check the court records before coming on air here, and there is nothing new at this time.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with reporter Sam Moylan, and Sam, I wonder if we could briefly talk about another story. This is from last week. I'm kind of springing this on you, but no pun intended. but I've been sneezing my head off, and so this one stuck out at me. Here's the headline. Here's which three Utah cities now rank among these nation's worst for pollen allergies. These are, I guess, the big cities in Utah. They're now among the worst.
Yeah. This one is unfortunate for us here in Salt Lake and some other parts of Utah. But there was this new report that came out that said Ogden, Provo, and Salt Lake were among the top 20 worst cities in the country for pollen allergies right now.
So warmer temperatures and drought conditions, I guess, contribute to this. Warmer temperatures, you get plants spreading pollen earlier, and less water means the pollen stays longer. Did I get that right?
Yeah. No, that is spot on. Yeah, we've had an unusually warm winter. It was basically this high pressure system that came in and was trapping this warm air, and it was really detrimental to our ski resorts. And as everyone has seen, we've had very little snow. But these conditions, in turn, have also triggered more pollen spikes. Like it was interesting because in December we actually saw some trees begin to start budding because they thought it was spring. So we've had, you know, these unusual, like, early flowering and causing more pollen. And then it's also extending, like, causing these longer pollen seasons than we're used to. It's very interesting because actually these three cities, Salt Lake, Provo, and Ogden, were ranked among the best just the year prior to live if you have pollen allergies. So it's a very, very different turn of events this year.
I was interested. The national report indicated that the top cities in the past were concentrated mostly in the Southeast, but now that's not the case.
Yeah, there was a good amount of Western cities this year, and you know, we could likely say that's because of this high pressure system that we had that was affecting most of the West. It wasn't just us.
So I guess the usual advice from experts, right? Close your windows, change your clothes when you come inside, take a shower, that kind of thing.
Yep. That was the advice that I got from an allergist. And Yeah, I mean, there's only so much you can do to limit it. But if you, you know, try to shower and then, you know, not wear your outdoor clothes inside, and the usual, like, limit your exposure when you're inside your home so that your body has a break, she said, can be helpful.
Yeah. I guess my method of, you know, sneezing, and cursing all trees, that's probably not, that's probably counterproductive. Because I
you know, probably a little bit, but
because I know mine is tree pollen, but and eventually, you know, it goes away. But I notice it's been bad for me and a lot of people this year, so I wanted to get this story in. Thank you for telling us about this.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Salt Lake Tribune reporter Sam Moylan, and you're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Following another break, here is the headline, how the Trump administration may erase history and science at Utah's national parks. We'll be talking with reporter Brooke Larson following this break.
I'm Julie Rose, host of the Top of Mind podcast. The death penalty has long divided Christians.
God says you forfeited your life when you murder because you've actually attacked me.
I've just become more and more convinced that there's no justifiable reason for the death penalty. There's nobody who's beyond the reach of God's grace.
Christianity and capital punishment are top of mind.
Tune in Sunday morning at 9 here on UPR.
Hi, this is Steve Williams, and you can tune in for a selection of jazz music from the Jazz Time with Steve Williams Archives. Public radio is where jazz music lives. Nowhere else. It really doesn't. So, please make contributions next week. We're in the pledge drive, so it's always appreciated that listeners who enjoy the music also make their contribution to keep it going. That's Sunday from 6 to 10 p.m. here on Utah Public Radio.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We bring in Salt Lake Tribune reporter Brooke Larson. Brooke, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. So here's the headline, how the Trump administration may erase history and science at Utah's national parks. It's a new order, I guess, out of the Trump administration, which would is possibly affecting signs, exhibits, I guess, other materials?
Yeah, so this order actually was issued last year, and National Park staff had to submit possible signs that were out of compliance with this executive order and an order that followed from the Secretary of Interior, Doug Burgum. And this list was just leaked earlier this month, so that's why, you know, we at the Tribune and initially the Washington Post found it and verified this list that was leaked.
So, what does the order say? What are they looking at? What do they want to change?
Yeah, so basically, signs that talk about U.S. history in a way that, you know, inappropriately talks poorly about Americans is what the order says, or, you know, talks about the aspects of the park in any way other than its beauty, abundance, or grandeur, which, you know, that particularly seems to be creating quite a bit of confusion for park staff in terms of what does or doesn't meet this standard, according to this list that was leaked.
My understanding is what's happened is the order went out, and the Trump administration wants park officials, workers, to suggest things that might come under the order.
Yeah. So, you know, this list that was leaked has the submissions from different parks. So in Utah, we have, you know, various, we have the classic national parks that people know about, Bryce, Zion, Arches. We also have a bunch of different monuments and national historic sites that are also managed by the National Park Service. So each of those submitted possible signs. Some of them said there were no signs that they felt were out of compliance with this order.
But those that did submit signs, they submitted ones, you know, that ranged from how they, the signs talked about things in history, such as racism or, you know, the forced removal of Indigenous people, to things like signs about flash floods, you know, and this is more of a safety thing, not really talking about the beauty of the national park. So there was a lot of language in there, like we would like to seek guidance from, you know, the National Park Service, from the Interior Department, of whether or not this is out of compliance or not.
One that stood out to me, this exhibit's been flagged by somebody in the park system, an exhibit that describes what almost drove the California condor to extinction in Bryce Canyon National Park.
Yeah, those ones were interesting to me. I'm guessing they were flagged because they talk about, you know, in, you know, a few decades ago, pesticides, lead ammunition, these things that have driven some species such as the condor to near extinction. And so my interpretation of why that was submitted was because, you know, of how it's talking about history and where it's placing the blame for the threat to certain species such as the condor.
Yeah. This one also stood out to me. Arches staff, quoting from your story, sought guidance on whether or not a sign about Edward Abbey, the deceased ranger. Tell me about that.
Yeah, that one was interesting to me as well. So there's a sign that talks about how visitation to Arches National Park has increased a lot in recent years. And, you know, part of the sign is talking about Edward Abbey, who was a former ranger at the park in the 1950s, and, you know, also famously wrote books such as Desert Solitaire and Monkey Wrench Gang. And Desert Solitaire and some of his other writing really argued against, you know, allowing too many tourists into the parks, kind of warned about the implications of that. And, you know, the sign talks about how, ironically, his writing inspired more people to visit Arches. And they didn't necessarily spell out why they submitted this sign. Just knowing the order and some of this context, visitation at national parks has become kind of a contentious topic lately. You know, Arches just canceled their timed entry system. It's become a political debate of how to manage visitation and tourism. And, you know, Edward Abbey is also kind of people probably have a lot of different feelings about him as a figure. So that may be a couple of reasons why that sign was submitted for review.
I just have a parenthetical question about that. Arches deleted their timed entry system. I don't know if we know how that's going now that it's, I guess, Wild West. You can just come and are the lines longer?
That's a good question for our Moab team.
Okay.
I mean, we're just starting kind of the tourism season. I think we will have a clear picture of the impact of this in a few months. I mean, maybe even by the end of this month with spring breaks, you know, but this just happened quite recently. So I don't think we can sort of clearly say at this point what the impact will be.
Sure, the Times Independent will be covering that. And by the way, I think Times Independent is part of the Tribune team now, so we'll look for that. So I guess back to this story. Do we know what the disposition of these, what's the process? I guess that this then goes to the Department of Interior and they decide yes or no on these exhibits?
Yeah, and, you know, in some places across the country, they've already seen signs come down. I did get confirmation, at least the National Park Service said to me that there have not been any signs removed in Zion National Park. You know, I'm based in St. George, so that's the park I cover most frequently. So I've been trying to keep tabs on that. But when I sent a follow-up asking about all parks, when I was, you know, pivoting to the statewide story, they did not give me a straight answer on that. I didn't get a response for a while, but recently after this story was published. They just basically said they're reviewing it and can't give more information than that at this time. So it's pretty difficult to get information from the Park Service and federal government on this at this time, but from what I have been able to confirm, it doesn't appear that at least Cyan has had any signs removed.
But there's another one standing out to me. Do you have a photo of this one? Golden Spike National Historic Park, a sign which discusses discrimination and violence against ethnic minorities, in this case, the Chinese railroad workers, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were a couple at Golden Spike that stood out to me. This one, there was one about like how it's talking about racism. And, you know, a lot of these signs, this one is an example of that, where the park staff submitted it and, you know, said that they overall thought the sign was fine, but there may be a couple sentences that they were flagging. And there was, you know, a couple sentences here that, you know, basically said that racism, you know, has led to violence and harm for people across U.S. history. So that was the bit of that sign that they flagged. And then there was another sign at Golden Spike that talked about how, you know, the U.S. military supported kind of the mass killing of bison to deprive indigenous people of food. And the submission said that sign could be seen as harsh, but it aligns with documented history. Mm.
Now, the government is saying that, quoting them, the vast majority of the flag materials remain unchanged. You have some quotes from some Democratic senators. They're not agreeing with this process.
Yeah, so a few Democratic senators spoke on the U.S. Senate floor last week, really kind of slamming the Trump administration's efforts on this. Senator Heinrich of New Mexico and Senator Merkley of Oregon had, you know, led this letter to the National Park Service or the Interior Department more broadly a couple weeks ago, demanding information on this. And basically all of these senators called this effort authoritarian, that, you know, I think there's this quote from Merkley. This was sort of a theme that loving America means embracing, you know, our collective effort to learn from our shortcomings. So that was a theme of what the senators had to say last week, the Democratic senators.
Reporter Brooke Larson, thanks for telling us about this. I want to move to another story. Record heat is fast-tracking Utah's already dire water outlook. So record low snowpack, and that means we're reaching peak water, peak flow abnormally early. So you took a look at this and how this would affect our major reservoirs. And I guess the news is it's not good. Not good news.
Yeah, not good. I mean, with this heat wave this week that some of my, you know, other folks at the Tribune have reported on, it's likely going to, you know, escalate the melting of our already pretty dismal snowpack. So we may see peak flows, you know, peak snow melt much earlier than usual. And, you know, just as you said, the larger story here is just that we're in a pretty dismal place for water supply, particularly, I mean, in the Great Salt Lake Basin as well, but I primarily report on the Colorado River Basin, and we're looking at some of the lowest forecasted levels at Lake Powell since the reservoir was filled.
So Lake Powell, we might hit power pool. What is that?
Yep, so that is the level below which water can no longer, you know, flow through the turbines in Glen Canyon Dam and generate electricity. It also, you know, has long-term implications because the penstocks, the river outlets that the river could flow through instead to go downstream just were not engineered, constructed for consistent long-term releases of the water. So it both, you know, has implications for the states that receive electricity from Glen Canyon Dam, as well as, you know, Grand Canyon, Lake Mead, and the three states in Mexico downstream that depend on, you know, consistent water flowing out of Lake Powell.
Now, is the government decided to do extra releases from Flaming Gorge to help?
So what that will look like exactly is still being discussed, but based on what I'm hearing, I think that is like the primary way the Bureau of Reclamation, which, you know, oversees these reservoirs, has to keep Lake Powell up, as well as reducing how much water is released from Powell. So it's very likely that we will see around 500,000 acre feet released from upstream reservoirs. And there's about three main ones in the Colorado River Basin that they can pull from, but for various reasons, Flaming Gorge is the one that is going to be providing the bulk of that. And Flaming Gorge is obviously another popular large reservoir in Utah. So a lot of the water that will be, you know, going down to help prop up Powell will be coming out of Flaming Gorge through the Green River to meet the Colorado.
One more thing briefly on this. There's a certain, I don't know, flow or level water that has to be released from the upper states to the lower states. I guess that's at Lee's Ferry, right?
Yep.
And given this drought, the upper states might not reach that. And that would, I guess, trigger a continuing. We already have a fight between upper and lower basin states.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we're getting into, you know, some experts call it like the tripwire, this under the Colorado River Compact. There's a certain amount of water that is supposed to make it past Lee's Ferry every year, and particularly on a 10-year rolling average, like a 10-year aggregate. And so there's some, the upper basin, which, you know, is Utah, Colorado, Wyoming, and New Mexico, and the lower basin, which is Arizona, California, Nevada, have different interpretations of what that means. But the lower basin views that as that the upper basin states, including Utah, have an obligation to deliver that amount. And as I've come on here and talked about before, these states are in tense negotiations right now about new guidelines for how to manage the river during these dry years. And the thing Utah really wants out of those negotiations is agreement from the lower basin of a compact waiver, basically that those states won't sue Utah, Colorado, New Mexico, Wyoming, if they can't, if, you know, there's not enough water to send down. If they don't reach that deal this year, there is a possibility that litigation could happen as soon as next year. So we're definitely getting into, you know, I feel like it's sort of been like Boy Who Cried Wolf for a while on Colorado River issues, but this year feels like all of these things people have been talking about for years, you know, the critical low levels, the threat of litigation is just becoming nearer and nearer.
Well, we've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Brooke Larson. Brooke, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Tom.
Well, it's time for our underplayed stories of the week. Robert Gerke, what's your underplayed story?
Potentially not underplayed, but it just posted today. Sean Means did a piece looking at the aftermath of a New York Times investigation into Cesar Chavez and allegations that he had sexually abused some teenagers when he was the head of a agricultural union. It's got local governments considering whether they should take his name off streets. Fifth South in Salt Lake, Ogden, West Valley, I'll have streets named after Cesar Chavez, and most of the consensus seems to be that they're either looking at it, or if the allegations turn out to be true, they should rename those streets that were sort of named in his honor, over a decade ago in most cases. So you can check it out at sltrib.com.
sltrib.com for that one. Sam Moylan, what's your underplayed story?
Yeah, another possibly not underplayed, but also one that I think, deserves more attention. Not to stick to a theme, but my colleague Peyton did a story on the planned ICE detention center, and looking at some of the claims they've made about how it's going to benefit the economy here, but they won't actually show how they got their numbers. So I thought it was really interesting. She worked with really limited information. I said it's going to create almost 10,000 jobs and over $238 million in tax revenue, but they wouldn't actually tell us, any of their math. So she looked at, other studies that have done specifically on prisons and how those have impacted the economy, kind of do a comparison through research. And kind of, trying to paint a picture of what this might look like for our economy here.
All right. Check that out at sltrib.com. Brooke Larson, what's your underplayed story?
Yeah, well, I was going to shout out Peyton's story as well. I just echo what Sam was saying, but I had a backup in case someone else chose it. And I will shout out this story from my corner of the state, how this Utah record label came to host book clubs, movie nights, and a sense of belonging. It's a story from one of our interns who's a student at Utah Tech, Lexi Bergano. It's about a record label in St. George called Amusement Co. Records. And, I think it might just give a glimpse into St. George and Washington County's music and art scene that maybe some of our readers up north aren't aware of. So I think it's a good community story.
All right. Check that out at sltrib.com as well. Well, you've been listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. We've been talking with politics reporter Robert Gerke. Robert, thanks so much for coming on.
Yeah, have a great weekend, Tom.
You too. We've also been talking with reporter Sam Moylan. Sam, thank you.
Thanks so much, Tom.
thank you. And reporter Brooke Larson has been with us. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Tom. Have a good weekend.
You too. And I'm Tom Williams. Thanks so much for listening. Hope you'll be with me again next week.